The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
You grew up on Staten Island?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn.
Oh.
Which is fairly...
Let's hear your accent.
People tell... I don't really have one.
I mean, my mother was from Brooklyn. She had a pretty heavy accent.
I could do it. I could talk like that.
Oh, there we go. I could do Jersey, too. No, Anthony, get out of the pool. Leave your sister alone.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Dave's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins. And joining me as always is Rob Janicki. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Keith. How are you?
I'm good, Rob. Lately, I've been studying to get my stevedore license, just in case this whole podcast thing goes, belly up.
Whenever I meet a boy, I start asking myself, is he right for me? And I don't know, Mary. I really don't know. There was one you wrote about. His name was Alex, I think. Why did that fall through? That's just it, Mary. I don't know. I can't for the life of me figure out what happened.
Deborah Hollins led a wildly diverse career in music over the years. An exceptional singer and songwriter, she rose to prominence in the group Animal Logic. After being in the biggest band in the world for a number of years, drummer Stuart Copeland decided he wasn't quite done just yet. So he tapped jazz bass player Stanley Clark on the shoulder, and the two decided to form a group. That group became Animal Logic, and a call was put forth to find a vocalist. Deborah proved she had the metal and the chops to front Animal Logic when she won the gig over hundreds of others. After recording two albums with Animal Logic, the band went on hiatus, and she formed folk supergroup The Refugees with Wendy Waldman and Sidney Bullens, and over the years has recorded six solo albums. Deborah also found time to earn a master's degree from California State University, Los Angeles, and would go on to run that university's commercial music program from 1998 to 2010. Deborah Holland joined Rob and I in Thunderlove Studios, and we talked about that Animal Logic debut album. Here's Rob and I having a chat with Deborah Holland. Hello, Deborah.
Hi.
Hey, Deborah, how are you?
I'm good. You guys?
Good.
And where are you, Keith? Where are you right now?
I'm in New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh, okay. And Rob, where are you?
I'm in New York. I'm in Staten Island, New York.
Where are you?
Well, I was in LA for most of my life, 33 years. And in 2010, I moved to Vancouver in Canada. And then about a year ago, I moved to, it's called the Sunshine Coast, which is, it's a peninsula, but you have to take a ferry to get here. There's no road.
Oh, wow.
It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I'd have to unplug everything. I would show you the view, but trust me, it's gorgeous.
House of love, and he knows what I'm thinking of. He's making friends in places high above. In the house of love, in the house of love. I had dreams that were laid to waste. I lost the time and I lost the taste. I need him now to meet me face to face. In the house of love, in the house of love. Someday I'll forget who it is, and what I do, he'll probably go. The message can only be his. Whatever it says, I need to know.
Someday
Was there a watershed moment for you musically that led you into music? A lot of folks we've talked to have been like, it was the Beatles. It was the Beatles. That's the recurring thing. It was like, we saw the Beatles. Was there something like that for you that said, I want that?
I would say it was more the 1970s singer-songwriter. Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, James Taylor, Bonnie Raitt, and then Linda Ronstadt. That was sort of my, I don't know. I've always been, I've also am a huge jazz fan. I like traditional folk music, you know, so I'm kind of all over the map. But I think you will find that it's guys who say the Beatles were it for them, not women.
That is 100% true.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just the music. It was also the throngs of girls screaming for right. them. I think that was tied up with, although I love the Beatles, I can't say I saw the Beatles and went, oh my God, I want to do that. That was never...
I'm not surprised at the answer you just gave about your musical background and what you listen to, because your music you make is so eclectic and so different. It's all over the map in a good way.
Yeah.
And
well, a good way in what you're saying, but it's been bad in terms of my career.
And I understand that, right? Because they can't peg you don't fit in a box.
Exactly.
The industry, and this is something else that we dealt with a lot with the artists we spoke to, their labels had no idea what to do with them. For the ones who were a little bit different, a little bit left of center, they didn't fit into, this is pop. And your music has all of the elements of just great musicianship. And wherever, you know, the songwriting was taking you, that's where you went. You didn't write to a genre. You just wrote
Yeah. Unfortunately, what the AAA format, which really would have been prime Animal Logic territory, wasn't really in where it got to when we put out our records. It was right after that. I think if we had hit that, we might have had a little bit more traction than we had. It's funny, I had an Animal Logic dream last night. I guess because I knew I was going to be talking to you guys. I dreamt that Stuart was putting together, I don't want to get into a thing. Never mind. But I had an Animal Logic dream last night. So what do you want to know?
What was that like to, you know, playing in LA, being in bands, and then auditioning, getting the gig? What's that like dancing around the edges of the industry and then almost literally being dropped right in the eye of the hurricane?
Surreal. Yeah, completely surreal.
You seem to have handled it well. The record's amazing.
I think so too. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely not an easy adjustment for me. And, you know, I had been used to calling all the shots. And now suddenly I'm in this sphere of, well, completely the opposite of that. But I eventually worked my way up and I did have a lot of input. I mean, they were my songs. So of course.
They're your song, right.
You know, and my voice. Yeah.
In spite of, you know, what you were dropped into and, you know, how quickly it seemed to have happened, they're your songs. You wrote them. Like that has to mean so much to you, I would think, then and even now.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But lucky for me, they weren't songwriters.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you have, were these songs written prior?
Most of them were. And then some of them I wrote before we recorded.
Okay.
Yeah. The two that I had already written that got me in the band were Spy in the House of Love and Firing Up the Sunset Gun. Those were the two demos that they heard and got interested. I know Elijah, I wrote after I got in the band. And I know I wrote I'm Sorry, Baby, I Want You in My Life after. I believe all the other songs had already been written.
Okay.
Yeah.
The lyrics for a lot of what I've heard, not just with Animal Logic, but, you know, beyond, very smart, very intuitive from what I, just my perception. But do you think that, you know, the music industry, I guess, as a whole, especially in I guess it would have been the late 80s, do you think they were, I don't think they were taking female songwriters very seriously. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not only were they not taking them seriously, but there wasn't much room for women in the industry. I mean, I had been trying to get a record deal for 10 years before Animal Logic. And often I would get, well, we already have Pat Benatar. So we don't want a kid going into the record store. He's only going to pick one record by a female. So we don't want the competition. So there was that. And still, even today, there'll be like, even not too long ago, I had a label say to me, we already have a female trio. You know, as if you would ever say that to men. We already have a four-piece male group. You know, we've already got a male duo. So it still is happening.
Yeah.
Although it's not as bad as when back then. Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, that the Pat Benatar thing did, that actually was said to me from Chrysalis Records.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Well, then what do you want? Trouble?
Trouble. Listen, if trouble means something that makes you catch your breath, if trouble means something that makes your blood run through your veins like seltzer water, Adam, my man, give me trouble.
The barrier to entry to do and to get your music heard as you want it now is less than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. You don't even need to distribute a physical product anymore.
Well, that's pretty much what I do now. And yes, of course it's easy, but no one hears it. Without that big machinery behind you, it's very difficult to get any kind of traction anymore. So it's good and bad. I miss the shitty old music business. It was shitty, but at least it had parameters and tiers and a way of making things work. But now that people don't buy physical product, there really is no music business anymore.
Not as we knew it, certainly.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, you guys probably buy records, I'm going to guess.
Yes, I still do.
Vinyl?
Yep.
I do, yeah.
I do listen to, I do stream music because there is, it's easy. And
sure.
It's quick and it's a great way to, I think it's a great way to discover music.
Absolutely.
And then when I fall in love with something, I buy it. I buy it.
But you know you're the exception.
I do.
Yeah.
100%.
I'm Keith will always say I'm a little bit too optimistic maybe, but you know, I want the younger generations, I want them to appreciate physical music, but I want them to be able to put the needle on the record and hear that crackle and the anticipation of what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Read the liner notes, read the lyrics, look at the artwork.
Absolutely.
You know, it used to be an experience.
Yes. Know? Yes. But it is no more.
No, I know. But maybe in some crazy world, we can figure out a way of at least if we keep talking about it. I know it's never going to come back to what it was, but maybe it can stay alive. It doesn't have to disappear completely.
I hope so. Maybe. I hope you're right. Yeah.
I don't share the optimism. I think that we'll always have a little niche group like ourselves.
That's kind of what I think. But yeah.
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 I have a goofy question.
Mm-hmm.
In your song, Someday We'll Understand, you sing, Someday We'll Understand the Strange Ways of Woman and Man.
Mm-hmm.
Could you be a little bit more specific on when someday is? Because I'm still trying to figure that shit out.
Well, it never came, did it? I think that was wishful thinking. I was a lot younger. Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
Damn it.
Been obvious, we get along so well. It's little things that bother us, but
Love is not a constant state. It has to ebb and flow. One of us will pull, and the other one they must let go. You don't look down when you're on a high tight wire. We never can resist. That's when everything we do backfires. I wanna be with you. I wanna be apart. You wanna stay away. Wanna totally commit your heart.
I will tell you guys now, this will be the first public announcement. Animal Logic actually has two new songs that we're going to release.
Wow.
What I would like to do is to press a 45 because it's only two songs. I know that the Animal Logic fans out there would be most appreciative if it wasn't just a digital release.
Yeah, you're right. Like if it were to come out on vinyl now, they would absolutely want
that. I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's in the hands of one person who maybe could make this happen. But if he, I can't say who it is, but if he turns it down, then we're just going to do it ourselves. So, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I will tell you, I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of our critical reception was terrible.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Because they were expecting, when they heard that Stanley Clark and Stuart Copeland were forming a band, they all expected it was going to be this kind of experimental jazz thing. And critics were hugely disappointed that it was a pop band. We got a lot of bad reviews. I think if we had been unknown, like three unknown people, we would have had a better shot.
Yeah.
The one thing I really like about your songs, Deborah, is the universality of it. And that's something that carries through all of your songs.
Mm.
I'm curious how you're writing has sort of changed and your approach to universality as you've been writing songs. Have you found that to be the case?
I would have to say that, you know, in those days I wrote a lot about love, falling in love, falling out of love. Well, actually I still write about falling out of love. I haven't written a I write songs now for me. I don't even think about that. I know that hardly anybody's going to hear them. So, you know, I have a pretty tiny audience. So I just write what I need to write for my own sanity. Writing is therapy for me. I mean, yes, in the back of my mind while I'm writing a song, that's bullshit. That's not true. I am thinking about an audience as well. But I don't think anything I'm feeling or writing about is so unique that it wouldn't, that other people wouldn't feel the same way.
Agreed. Now, as an artist, do you find that freeing that you're writing for yourself?
Yes. Yes. I think I'm writing now like the best songs I've ever written, but maybe every writer thinks that. I do think I'm writing lyrically. I know I'm better now than I was then. I'm positive.
You teach songwriting.
Yeah, I do.
So this let's go down this little path a little bit. How does one go from the music business to the walls of academia? That's like, seriously, I think that's like a 180 degree shift. Did you find that to be the case as you did it?
No, because I was only teaching. I was teaching what they, well, I started off at Cal State LA, and it was a master's program in commercial music, which really just meant popular music. So everything that I was teaching kind of was in my wheelhouse. You know, I wasn't really, it was all kind of very familiar territory to me. And I was teaching songwriting, but now I wouldn't say I teach songwriting. I facilitate workshops but it's for people who already write. And I'm very good at helping someone get their song to be better. I've gotten very good at that. I think my students, I wouldn't even really call them students, but I have like the same group of people that have been coming to see me now for many years, and they think that. So I don't try to get anybody to, like, I'm not one of these. There's lots of hit songwriters out there who are there. They try to get people to write hit songs. So that's not what I do. I just take what a person does, whatever style it is, and just try and make it a better song, if that makes sense.
Across various genres, then, I assume, country, folk, pop,
yeah.
Rock.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, any genre. But when I was in academia, then it was a more formalized approach to songwriting. Like, I don't want to get too technical, but so there's different songwriting forms. Like, there's AABA or verse chorus or 12-bar blues. So I would break down everything, you know, discuss melody. How do you get a good melody? All that kind of stuff, you know, work on lyrics, write this type of lyrics, analyze lyrics.
Do you coach or encourage a writing style? For example, if you're only writing for yourself, is that something you would tell your I can't think of another word for students, the people who you're coaching?
I've only had recently one writer who's not a singer-songwriter, and he wants to write songs for other people. So I help him with that, you know. So that would be different. Those would be different. That would be a completely different critique than a person who's a singer-songwriter who's writing for themselves. Yeah. I mean, some of the things are the same. A lot of the things are the same. But most of the people that come to my workshops now, they're not trying to write a hit song for, I don't even know who. The business of songwriting has changed so much since I first started out. I mean, there's never a song that doesn't have three writers on it. So, you know, or more if it's R&B or, you know, hip hop, and it's got eight writers on it. So I'm not doing that kind of coaching.
People now are writing to the algorithms of Spotify.
Yes, exactly.
And do you write music first and then put lyrics to it? Do you write lyrics and then maybe, you know, come up with the melody based on, you know, the flow of the lyrics? How does your songwriting happen?
Most of the time, 90% of the time, I write music and lyrics together. Hmm. And I don't even go to the next verse until the first verse is done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. For Animal Logic, that would have been a different process and a different time in my life. I was going to tell you guys something. Oh, I think I've talked about this before in interviews, but damn it. I'm sorry. Let me turn that off too. Nobody should be. Okay. Right before I got into Animal Logic, I had decided I wasn't going to get a record deal and I wasn't going to be on the cover of Rolling Stone. And so I was going to go back. My dog is bugging me, so I'm just going to put her up on my lap.
Aww.
Maggie, say hi.
Hey, Maggie.
I had decided that it wasn't going to happen for me, and I was going to go back to writing songs how I wrote songs when I was first starting to write songs, which was just write for myself. And that's when I wrote Spying the House of Love and Firing Up the Sunset Gun. And of course, those were the two songs that got me in Animal Logic.
Yep.
So I tell my songwriting students that story, because to me, what I was doing before then was I was trying to do a cross between what I wanted to do and what I thought the record companies wanted. And it was coming out like nothing. It was too bland. I find the process of, if you have music written and then you go to try and put lyrics to it, to be the most difficult. Occasionally I've had lyrics and then set it to music, but most of the time, at least for the past however many years, I do it at the same time.
Right. So as you're playing some chords or there's a melody
exactly.
that you're playing, the
I start to
lyrics,
sing something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
I mean, I have ideas for songs.
Right.
I have like song titles and song ideas, and I'm thinking about that, but definitely at the same time. Yeah.
Do you have favorite songwriters or maybe even lyricists, you know, that you still are, you know,
really big fan of? Well, I still think Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon are maybe the two greatest songwriters ever.
Yeah.
So yes. Although other than those two, I mean, of course Dylan is mm-hmm. great, and of course the Beatles are great. But Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon to me that's like the gold standard.
Yeah, that's impossible to argue with.
So, but I like lots of new songwriters too. Yeah, there's plenty of great songwriters. Well, there's a Canadian guy named Donovan Woods. Have you heard of him?
I have not.
Yeah, I think he's amazing. I've got every one of his records and I follow him. And I've even written reviews of his records and concerts. There's so many.
Yeah.
You know, I guess since I've been in Canada, I've discovered more Canadian singer-songwriters. But yeah. I mean, if I looked at I'll open up my iTunes for a second and just look at some playlists. Brandi Carlile, of course, Aoife O'Donovan, Bahamas, Jenny Lewis, Leif Volebeck, he's another Canadian that I really love. Ron Sexsmith, another Canadian. I loved the Civil Wars. I was brokenhearted when they broke up. There's a band called the Weepies that I loved. So anyway, I think there's tons of great songs being written.
A question about Animal Logic going back. I can't find that first record streamable.
You can now, but I only as a bootleg. I released it.
Okay.
It's got a different album cover.
It just showed up, I think, on Spotify, right?
Oh, maybe. I think it was a year ago already that I put it up.
Okay. But it's labeled as 2020, I think, right? Maybe.
Yes. Yeah. That seems right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah. I don't know who owns it. And I don't know why it was never released. So we just decided to put it out ourselves. I don't have the original artwork, so I couldn't use that. I couldn't register the songs, so I changed the titles. You'll notice that the titles are all different. But I only did that because it wasn't available, and that pissed me off. I mean, I would have been happy if somebody had released it, but I don't even know who put out the second record. That's a mystery too. Must be Universal, because I think IRS was sold to EMI, and then I don't even know.
The building of human rights would be one of the foundation stones on which we would build in the world an atmosphere in which peace could grow.
I'm going to share with you an experience I had just this morning or this evening. I was listening to "I Am a Union Woman" off the Panic Is On.
Okay.
Right. And I'm loving it. I'm digging it. I'm like, wow, this is a really, really powerful song. And then right towards the end, this percussion comes in out of nowhere. And I have my headphones on and I started looking around and I thought someone was banging on my wall.
Oh, that's funny.
And as I was listening to it, I'm like, all right, this is a folk album. Just taking these songs from the 30s and reinterpreting. They're originally folk songs. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that you considered it more of an experimental album. And I kind of thought that was an interesting approach. And is that something you went into the studio and said, I'm going to approach these traditional folk songs? And
I wouldn't say it was, I said it was experimental. It was a concept. And the concept was, this was my master's thesis, by the way. That's what The Panic Is On is.
Oh.
Yeah. The idea was to take songs that were written in the around the Great Depression, but they're different genres. Like there's two songs that were jazz, two songs that were folk, two songs that were country, I forget what else is on that record, but by not having guitar or piano, it just focused more on the lyrics because all the lyrics tied together as songs about the Great Depression, even though they were different genres. So that was the idea. And also I hardly had any money, so it cost nothing to, it was like, it cost me $200 to record that record.
Well, you wouldn't know it from what I heard. Sounds great.
Thank you. So if I said experimental, I don't think that, it was more of a concept. Yeah. I don't know why I said it. Cause really it was kind of experimental, I guess, in its own way, you know,
as a thesis should be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Do you have any more questions about the Poor Abandoned album?
What was the audition process like for you? I picture, you know, Broadway, going on a stage, singing, and everyone sitting in the dark. Was that what it was like?
No.
A little bit?
No. Stuart, Stanley, and Andy were in a room, and I came in. I had a gig that night with a little country duo that I had called Twang. So I came in a pink thrift store dress and cowboy boots. And, you know, there were other women there, you know, in spandex and hair and makeup, you know, and all that stuff. And I just went in. I had been in bands with guys. I'd been the only woman in all male bands since I was a teenager. And so I said, I'm just going to go in there and treat them like any guy musicians. And that's what I did. I went in and they learned Spy in the House of Love. And then I think we did a blues song. We probably did a couple of Bonnie Raitt blues songs. I can't remember what else that I know they learned Spy in the House of Love while I was there. And it was very relaxed, very easy. I wasn't even nervous.
Really?
Yeah. I just thought it was kind of a hoot.
Do you remember how long the recording process for the album took? I mean, back then, I know sometimes it would be, it was longer then, I think, than now.
Yeah. How it worked was I went to England and Stuart and I kind of made, not demos, but blueprints of all the songs. He had a Fairlight back then. You know what a Fairlight is? It was this incredibly expensive synthesizer, basically. And we did kind of basic outlines of all the songs, except for probably, did we do Elijah? I'm not sure if we did the two songs that I wrote after that. I can't remember. And then we came back and we went in the studio. And Andy Summers had quit the night before. And the guys, I don't know who, somebody called up Joe Walsh to replace Andy. I have no idea how that happened, but they called up. Even though I turned this off, I'm still getting pings here. Okay, sorry about that.
That's okay.
And the story is, whoever he was talking to, Joe Walsh, said, I've been waiting for this call my whole life. And then he never showed up. So here we are in the studio. recording spy in the House of Love, and I had had a fun cover bar band that Michael Thompson had been in, the guitar player who ended up playing. And I called up Michael and I said, get your ass over here really quick. And he did. And Michael ended up being the guitar player on the record for most of the songs.
Wow.
And then I think the rest of the recording went pretty quickly. What took forever was the mixing.
Yeah.
It was polo season. So Stanley and I, Stuart was playing polo then. Stanley and I had to go to London. We mixed the record in London. So I was in London, which was great. I was there for 5 weeks. I got to live in London. That took forever. Yeah.
That is the first time I've ever heard of a record being delayed because of polo.
Polo. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Talk about your champagne problems.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, it's cool as hell because, I mean,
yeah,
who plays polo? But
I don't remember how long the recording took. I don't think it was that. I want to say it wasn't that long, but it must have been. Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
Was it recorded live, or did you do, you know, did you go in and do your vocals, and did you, like, how did the interaction work?
Nothing was live except for Stuart and Stanley.
Okay.
Yeah.
The production on the record.
Hold on a second. That record, since we had already had the stuff in the Fairlight, I guess the Fairlight blueprint was used as like a click track.
Okay.
You know who knows all this stuff is Jeff Seitz, Stuart's main, who's been with Stuart since the Police days. He knows all this stuff, and he was the engineer on it too, so. But that's my memory is how we did that record.
When you toured that record, what was the reception like?
Mixed. They weren't expecting a pop band. Yeah, there's a couple things that happened. Well, in Brazil, I've talked about this before. Somebody in the audience went like this to me. Oops, wait a minute. How do I do this? Yeah, like get out of I was in the way of Stuart. And in Amsterdam, somebody threw a beer can on the stage. Yeah, they weren't thrilled. Yeah, they weren't happy. They weren't expecting a pop band. Yeah. It got better as time went on, but yeah, wasn't easy.
The expectation of the experimental sound, what people thought they were getting.
Yeah.
You know, is that because Stanley was in the band? Like,
absolutely. No, if it had just been a rock bass player, I don't think that would have happened. Yeah.
I guess from your point of view and mine, now that we're talking about this, it would have been cool if people would have expected or lower the expectations of what the sound was going to be like.
And I just know that's not how fans and critics are, though, right?
No.
You know, if you're a Police fan, you want to hear more music that sounds like that. And if you're a Stanley Clark fan, you want to hear more fusion jazz. I mean, it's just, you know, that's just how it goes.
What is the state of Animal Logic now? You've got the new two songs coming out.
Well, we've done these two songs, and they will come out. I don't know when. Hopefully sooner than later. My hope is that promoters find out about it and want to pay us a gazillion dollars to do gigs, and then we go record another album. That would be winning the lottery for me, but I'll take anything I can get.
Are these two songs, they're new because no one has heard them, or are they new because you just are they newly written as well? Or
we were going to try and record an album.
Okay.
The year before COVID, and we got it through, I want to say how many, six songs, eight songs, something like that. And then we just could never get back together, and nothing was ever going to happen. So I finished the songs myself and released an EP in 2020. If you look on it, Stuart plays drums on almost all the songs on that. But I couldn't use any of Stanley's bass parts. But I had two songs left that had great bass playing and great drumming. And so I finished those two myself and mixed them and mastered them and with their approval. And they both said they liked them, and they thought releasing it as Animalogic would be a cool idea. So that's where that happened. Once that happens, I couldn't tell you what will happen. I just told you my wish list, you know. And if we do ever go make another record, Stuart's not really that interested in playing drum parts to pre-existing songs anymore. And that's not really Stanley's thing either. So my idea is that I would bring lyrics and we would write the songs. We'd write and record the songs together at the same time.
Wow.
That's how I would like to do. If we're ever going to do another Animalogic record, that'd be the only way to do it.
Yeah. And guess what? If you do it like what? That, all the critics and the fans who wanted the experimentation,
yeah,
they're going to get
They'll
it
be
that
happy.
Way. Yeah. Well, because
so most of those critics are retired.
Well, we'll get it to new ones who will appreciate it.
Yeah.
Can we ever expect to see Deborah Holland out here on the East Coast in New York City or anything like that?
Unlikely. The only thing that could happen is I also have a trio called The Refugees. Yeah, the three of us, it's very possible we will do some more gigs. Matter of fact, we might be in Connecticut next summer.
Oh, great.
Oh,
I don't want to jump the gun at a festival, so we'll see. Cool. There we go. Fingers crossed. I can't find the camera on this thing.
Yeah, you've got to get used to going the wrong way.
Yeah. It's so weird. Yeah.
Great, Deborah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for everything.
Yeah, my pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was great.
All right.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Many thanks to Deborah Holland. The songs you heard during this podcast were all taken from Animalogic's self-titled debut album. And they were There's a Spy in the House of Love, Someday We'll Understand, and As Soon as the Sun Goes Down. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums, and on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_albums.
As always, thanks to Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Peyton Janicki, Nathan Sage, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Michael Janicki, and of course, our executive producer,
Rufus Thunderwolf.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.